we're getting an intimate look at life in Utah from the perspective of native-born Terry Tempest Williams. She's a much-admired author of books and articles that weave themes of identity and landscape, faith and resistance. Her latest book explores the mysteries of her mother's life. It's called When Women Were Birds, 54 Variations on Voice. I was recently driving into Salt Lake City and driving by this great salt lake, and I just thought, this is just a big salty wasteland, and then I'm coming into Salt Lake City, and then I read your book, and it's just a jungle of all sorts of natural and historic and environmental wonder. Tell us about appreciating Utah, and specifically the Great Salt Lake.
Well, I have to tell you, my father would be in agreement with you. He does think it's a floating cesspool. And on summer nights, if the wind blows just right, you can smell sulfur. And there's a lot of brine flies, as well as shrimp. I love Great Salt Lake. It's the size of Delaware and Rhode Island. I think it's a magical place. It's our Serengeti. It's a beautiful reflective mirror that calls birds home. Hundreds of species, everything from avocets to black-necked stilts to long-billed curlews. I think it's heaven. And it is a body of water that nobody can drink in the desert.
Well, that's interesting. Now, on your anniversary, I love the way you wrote about how you toasted to marriage and to the indomitable spirit of the Great Salt Lake. Why would you mix that together on your anniversary?
Great question. Great Salt Lake is a grand paradox. I think marriage is too. Nothing is as it appears. And what I love about Great Salt Lake is it can't be controlled. In the same way that I think marriage is a wild landscape, Great Salt Lake is a wild landscape. I love Great Salt Lake. It holds you. You do float. There's bison out on Antelope Island. And every time I go out there, I see something miraculous. It stretches your eyes.
I find it so interesting that you've got this pioneer heritage. You're a member of the Mormon Church. You call yourself a unconventional Mormon, I believe. And then you think about Brigham Young, who would have been, you know, from your clan, like the patriarch, and he took his band of faithful followers out there in 1847, stood right there and said, this is the place. How do you tie your Mormon heritage and your love of nature and your concern for environmental justice and so on all together?
I don't think there's any separation. I mean, my ancestors came to Great Salt Lake for religious sovereignty. The salt desert was a perfect place. They didn't think they would be persecuted because who else would come live here? They quickly learned that there were many native people that lived here prior. But I think a love of land, a love of place, a love of family tied to a spiritual sensibility of land is deeply rooted in the traditional Mormon values. That's changed. I think in many ways, as Harold Bloom has said, the Mormon religion is the American religion. It's become much more conservative, much more corporate. Nevertheless, it is community-based, and I love that about it. They are my people. It's a language I understand. But I think Utah is changing politically because the people in Utah are changing, and I think largely because of the beauty of the land. Most of Utah's landscape is owned by the federal government, either in forests or BLM, Bureau of Land Management. We have 22 million acres of BLM lands. We're asking Congress for 9.2 million acres to be protected as wilderness, as part of America's Red Rock Wilderness Bill, now before Congress. We're hoping that Canyonlands National Park can be expanded to the million acres that Secretary Udall originally advocated for in 1961 under President Kennedy's administration. So the land still dictates and drives us. Is there a struggle? Yes, there is. Right now, I can tell you that our governor, Governor Herbert, would love to see these federal lands be taken out of the government jurisdiction and be sold off to the highest bidder. So you can imagine that there is a contention here among us. There is a lively debate going on. I loved that our governor said, you know, we wouldn't sell off our national parks. So that was a great relief. We have five national parks in Utah. It's not a drive-by state. It is a reservoir for our spirit. It brings you to your knees. And you can't take yourself very seriously living in Utah because the land is so grand before us.
That is powerful. It's easy to take yourself seriously, but when you get surrounded by the vast immensity and power of nature, it is a beautifully humbling thing, isn't it?
It is, and I think that's part of the reason why we're saying, with all of the oil and gas development that is occurring on our public lands, with Utah being the only state in the United States that is now being slated for tar sands development in a land that has very little water, we're in a drought condition, and at a time when we have a nuclear power plant that is slated for development construction on the banks of the Green River, we are saying, let us be conservative, let us be prudent, let us protect these lands that define us as Americans and protect what protects us. And it's a bedrock truth that these red rocks tell time differently. And again, as you suggest, remind us what it means to be human in a very humble way.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're speaking with Terry Tempest Williams. And Terry is well known and much loved in literary circles for her books Finding Beauty in a Broken World, Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place, and her latest book, When Women Were Birds. Terry, in your book, When Women Were Birds, it's clear birds in your native Utah are near and dear to your heart. What is it about birds that really resonates with you? How are they so close to your soul, and how are they a metaphor for you, for women?
I think birds are mediators between earth and spirit. I think birds are the great travelers. You know, when I think about my greatest travel book, Rick, it's Peterson's Field Guide to Western Birds. My grandmother gave me that when I was 5 years old. And I would pore over those color plates, and I would imagine the birds before I saw them. And then going out to Great Salt Lake as a child, I would go, ah, there is the white-faced ibis. There is meadowlark. There's, you know, the wren in the reeds. And I would write down the date that I saw them and the place that I saw them. So in a sense, my field guides have become my travel journals. And later, as a naturalist, I really can see what birds used to be there that you don't see anymore. You used to see rafts of redheads on the Great Salt Lake. You don't anymore because of pesticides, because of loss of habitat. So birds to me mark the moment, and they're certainly tied to my grandmother. And with all of her grandchildren, we all have those field guides that she gave us as children, and they become sacred texts.
Now, it's not just birds, because you are also enthusiastic about prairie dogs, of all things. Tell me about your fascination and your love of prairie dogs.
Well, I have to tell you, that is not matched also by members of my family.
They're considered a pest by a lot of people, aren't they?
Well, and growing up, you know, I come from a family of brothers, and they would go out on the sage flats with their shotguns and 22s, and they were called pop guts for reasons you can only imagine.
Pop guts. But, oh, my goodness.
And they were expendable. You know, you talk about the government viewing Utahns as virtual uninhabitants with nuclear testing. Well, prairie dogs are the ultimate uninhabitants, which is so ironic because they're a creature that understands community. Inside a prairie dog community, you can find over 283 different species of animals that are dependent on the prairie dog towns. Everything from rattlesnakes to burrowing owls to deer, antelope, marsh hawks, snowy plovers. Take away the prairie dog and you take away a varied world.
And these prairie dogs have this amazingly sophisticated community, like a town with language and everything.
They have burrows that are unbelievable, that stretch miles. I only wish I could see underground to know what that would be like, that world. They have such a sophisticated language system with prairie dog grammar. You know, for example, if you were to walk across a prairie dog town, they would say, blonde man with a red shirt walking through. If you
Come
came by
on,
the next
really?
Day carrying a gun, they would say,
blonde man
red shirt with gun. Blonde man, red shirt with dog. I mean, they are that sophisticated.
Whoa.
So next time you see a prairie dog, you have to stop and listen to their alert calls.
Good-looking blonde man with travel guide. Oh, that's really wild.
There was one study done by a biologist named Konstantin Vitovich, and please don't ask me to repeat that again, his last name. And what he found when they drug a European ferret across the town, a new vocabulary word came to be. When they did that 50 miles in another direction, that same word appeared in that prairie dog town. I mean, there's so much we don't know about how animals communicate.
And are they still endangered, or are they coming back, or are they just a pest for people who want to keep their golf course without holes in it?
Utah prairie dogs are threatened. They would be on the endangered species list, except for it's too political because of the ranching communities and the golf courses. You're exactly right. But there's great organizations like Wild Earth Guardians that are making sure that they're going to still be around for as long as they have been. These are Pleistocene creatures.
We're visiting with author Terry Tempest Williams right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Her latest book's a tribute to her mother's identity and how it influences her own. It's called When Women Were Birds. Terry links to many of her articles for The Progressive magazine on her website at coyoteclan.com. That's coyoteclan.com. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Sally's on the line in LaVille, Pennsylvania. Sally, thanks for your call.
Thank you, Rick and Terry. I was appreciating Utah. And, you know, I've been to a majority of the national parks in our country, and I cannot think of a more magical place than southern Utah and canyonlands in particular. I experienced one of the most amazing, looking back, 24-hour periods ever in the southeast quadrant of canyonlands known as the Needles District in an area called Elephant Canyon. And I had never heard of it, but a friend invited me to the area, and one day we headed out for a walk into this magical, otherworldly land of sandstone pillars and buttes and mesas and into this Elephant Canyon. And the day turned from sunny to billowing thunderstorms just as we were passing through this very narrow slot canyon. And we got out and huddled under a rock ledge and just sat there alone, seeing no one in this vast wilderness. And I thought back to what it was like for the Native Americans who lived in the region, the Anasazi. And after that, we trekked back to this little wilderness campground where we heated water. And I took a bath beneath the starry night sky after an amazing sunset. And you can just imagine being out in true darkness and silhouetted buttes and mesas and hot water heated on the open fire and the starry sky unlike anything I'd ever seen before. Truly, truly an amazing, mystical, magical, colorful land that just touched the poet and the deep spirit. And I could hardly believe it was in America, and I thought just how few people in America would know that something like this existed.
Now, Sally, you're from Pennsylvania, so you were just visiting Utah. Terry, as a resident of Utah, does that resonate with you?
Sally, you must be a poet. You just sent me into a trance. I was right there with you. And I think oftentimes visitors from outside of Utah can appreciate what is here sometimes even more than those of us who live here. I think of another resident of Pennsylvania who wrote so beautifully about America's Red Rock Wilderness, and that was Edward Abbey. He was also from Pennsylvania. He wrote a beautiful book called Desert Solitaire. Have you read that?
I have, actually.
I think his descriptions, like yours, are so beautiful. It truly is a landscape of the imagination, as you say.
To the west of Canyonlands, there was this landscape that reminded me of the moon. I thought, where in the world am I? And just the progression, I had come from the west through Zion, across through Bryce, and finishing off with Canyonlands. And after that night of bathing beneath the stars, I awoke to this horizontal sandstorm just blasting. Literally, I was sandblasted out of that spot.
there was no
real refuge, and quickly we gathered camp and barely could toss it into the car and survive and flee this sandblasting like I never imagined would occur. And then where we relocated, soon after that came a blizzard and a foot of snow atop. So,
well, you realize it's still a landscape under construction. It's erosional, and it's what you experienced is why there's windows in stones and arches and bridges.
There's no place like it that I know of in the world. And
I love how there are conspirators that say Mars doesn't exist. They've just simply taken pictures of Utah.
You know, Terry, it's interesting because in your book, When Women Were Birds, you wrote, "Indoor religion bored me. Outdoor religion did not." And listening to Sally describe her experience in Utah, it is almost a religious experience.
It's palpable. It's sensual. It's spiritual. Like, how can you not feel that and know that deep in the fabric of your being, to stand beneath the stars, nothing but you and God and the great, vast creation? And so I just really applaud you, Terry and Rick, for all of your public efforts to saving and defending and giving voice to the care and the wise stewarding of this.
The beautiful thing, Sally, is these are your lands, too, and
yes,
your voice matters.
Yes, and I speak mine as much opportunity as I can. It is my heart's passion and life's work as well.
Sally, thank you so much for your call. Those are beautiful sentiments and inspirational.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Sally.
Thank
you, Terry. Bye-bye.
Terry, when I listen to Sally and when I think about your experience and the way you've shared it so poetically and spiritually almost in your books, and also I think about our community and our nation and the, how high the stakes are, it really is quite hopeful, wouldn't you say, considering what we can do when we get together?
Absolutely. I think about Wallace Stegner, a native son of Utah. He often talked about the geography of hope and how we can try to create a society to match the scenery. It's what I call the open space of democracy. These public lands belong to all of us. And I do think it is immensely hopeful because it transcends time as we know it on the human scale. But as you say, it does require our vigilance. And I think it's what defines us as human beings. And the national parks are a uniquely American ideal. And we have to protect that, especially at a time when there are those powerful corporate interests that say what we need is oil. And I think there are many others in this country that are saying what we need is a future, and that future is in the land.
Terry, it's been a delight talking to you. I hope we can cross paths again, and best wishes. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Take special care.
You can post your thoughts and comments on anything you hear here on Travel with Rick Steves in the radio message board at ricksteves.com. And we include links to our guests in each week's program details in the same radio section of our website. Next up, a tour guide from Italy tells us how he finds a desert refuge in the vast Sahara in North Africa. 877-333-7425 is our phone number, and by email, it's radio at ricksteves.com.